From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, live from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. It is showtime tonight for Barack Obama. Bubba's been up and brilliant. Bill Clinton drove them wild in Charlotte, but it's not his time now. Mitt Romney's had his convention in Tampa. His troops are determined. The Cowboys beat the Giants last night, season opener, so football is out of the way, and it's the president's time now. His hard first term almost over. A second term, maybe, in front of him. And the country set to listen. The crowd here is fired up, yearning. This hour on point, President Obama's night to make his case, and you can join the conversation. What do you want, need, expect to hear from President Obama tonight? What does he need to say, to explain, to lay out? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are in the hall in Charlotte and wide open to your calls tonight. A big outdoor stadium appearance was moved indoors after this week's heavy rains in Charlotte. The place is packed. Speakers are already at the podium over my shoulder. Joe Biden up tonight. Watch out, Eva Longoria and more. And, of course, the president. With us to look ahead to his speech, his challenge tonight, Major Garrett, White House correspondent for the National Journal, a surpassingly fine reporter, was with us for Mitt Romney's night in Tampa. Good to have you here again, Major, right here in Charlotte.
Tom, great to be with you.
And with us from Washington, the one and only James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He was chief speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, whose name is getting a fresh workout from Republicans lately. Now he's a big eye and mind on the country, the world. James Fallows, welcome. James, it's wonderful to have you with us.
Tom, nice to talk to you, and hello to Major.
It's great to have you both here. The crowds are surging around us. They're packing into the hall already. But all kinds of musicians and speeches and the whole long drum roll. The whole week has been a drum roll. It is inevitable that it will be compared to this night, 4 years ago in Denver, the Mile High Stadium there. We were there. Major, I think you were there. Jim, you may have been in China. Let's just go back for a minute. It's hard to explain what it was. The excitement was so high. History being made, an African-American man standing to be nominated by a major party for the presidency of the United States. 80,000 spectators that night at Invesco Stadium. Here was Barack Obama.
I stand before you tonight because all across America, something is stirring. What the naysayers don't understand is that this election has never been about me. It's about you.
And he went on with language that is not entirely unlike language we've been hearing this week. Here's more of President Obama, then Senator Obama, that night in Denver.
We cannot turn back. America, we cannot turn back. Not with so much work to be done. Not with so many children to educate and so many veterans to care for. Not with an economy to fix and cities to rebuild and farms to save. Not with so many families to protect and so many lives to mend. America, we cannot turn back.
We cannot turn back. He could not know on that night just how big the job of fixing the economy would be by the time he took office. But, Major, take us back to that night in Denver, because it is the backdrop. It is that supercharged atmosphere infected the entire nation out of that stadium that night.
You know, Tom, I would like to start with the night before that big night, mm-hmm. because I was on the floor about 15 feet away from when Senator Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama's chief rival for the nomination, came to the floor and asked for his nomination to be accepted by acclamation. And that was a singular moment all by itself.
Yeah.
An African-American nominated by a major party for the presidency of the United States, mm-hmm. and all around me, men, women, black, white, Latino, Native American, weeping. I mean, they were struck by the moment. And I must tell you, when I think about it even now, it sends shivers down my spine because it was the true moment of history. The speech was great, but that actual mm-hmm. act of a major party for the first time in American history proclaiming to the world in America with its backdrop of history, the civil rights struggle and everything else.
Slavery.
Yes, this time has come. It was monumental, that moment itself. Then the speech. My position that night was almost as good as the night before. I was right at the edge of the stage. Mm. Right to the right of then Senator Obama. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To my right, behind me, was sort of the Hollywood section.
Yeah.
And that section was as moved as any part of that stadium, 83,000 strong. Almost from the moment then Senator Obama walked out, there were tears. And you just felt that it was a singular moment that we would probably not see again. The ambitions here were slightly smaller, 75,000 football stadium venue.
In Charlotte, yeah.
In Charlotte. And I'm quite confident that had the weather cooperated, the Obama team would have filled it. It would have been much more difficult, no question, than 2008. But they were prepared, willing, and ready to fill it. They did not, didn't have to, because the rain really dampened the thing, everything outdoors this week here in Charlotte.
Ironically, it's clear right now, but it came down in rivers this afternoon.
I was in that, and I can attest to it.
Jim Fallows, you were halfway around the world, I think, in China that night that the president was making his big speech in Denver 4 years ago. Does that put a wind at his back four years later, Jim, or is that the mountain he has to try and reclimb, or does he have to do something entirely new?
I think he has to do something entirely new. And in a way, the very fact that he's been being considered as a normal president now, that he's having all the frustrations of a normal administration dealing with economic problems, dealing with an unusually intransigent opposition, coping with the inevitable disappointment that goes from the promise of an incumbent who can say that anything's going to happen, and the promise of a challenger, and the realities of it, somebody who's been there for 4 years and nothing is quite the way that he has projected it. The fact of those normal problems is in a way, the confirmation of the achievement that Major was talking about. Of having the first non-white president be considered in normal terms is an important thing. I think the main thing he has to do, for which his wife Michelle Obama and his Democratic predecessor Bill Clinton set him up very well, is to explain what is ahead in the next 4 years. Michelle Obama presented him as a person, which he sometimes has difficulty doing in quite the same emotive way. Bill Clinton did a very deft job of sort of dealing with the opposition, and now his job is to say, okay, here are the reasons to hope that re-upping this commitment, sending me back for another 4 years, will actually be not just holding off an opposition that Democrats don't like, but will mean some actual things to look forward to.
Normal problems, but in an extraordinary times, Jim. I mean, he really did ride the magic in 08. Whether people were for him or against him, Republicans, some of them very prominently, mocked the magic, quote-unquote. But it was powerful.
Sure.
The problems have been deep. They've not even been normal problems. They've been extraordinary problems. But, you know, can a guy who came in with so much magic do it, just talking nuts and bolts and carpentry of normal problems?
Well, I'm sure that he needs to talk about more than that. And nomination speeches like this, acceptance speeches like this, are not usually the place for a State of the Union type laundry list of all the particulars. And again, Bill Clinton very usefully gave those particulars, sparing Obama the need to go into some of them. But I think he does need to give a combination of hope and specificity, that there's a reason to think that these next 4 years, the seeds that have been planted, he will say, in these previous 4 years will bear some fruit in these next four.
Here was former President Bill Clinton last night. The crowd was on its feet and just wild for it, calling for four more years of Bill Clinton, saying, you may not feel it yet, but he's laid the groundwork, and you will feel it. President Clinton.
He has laid the foundations for a new, modern, successful economy of shared prosperity. And if you will renew the president's contract, you will feel it. You will feel it.
Major Garrett, is the country ready to believe? Great speech from Bill Clinton. We'll see what the president does tonight. But is the country ready to believe that the foundation's been built in this term? We've still got the 8% plus unemployment for great things you will feel in the next term.
Tom, that's what this entire election is about, and we simply do not know the answers. All of us in this profession who can and do sift public policy surveys don't know the answer. We know this. The country is anxious. It feels it's on the wrong track, and it is less optimistic about its future than it has been in a good long while. Do all of those negative feelings redound only to President Obama? No. They redound to the political system generally, and they also reflect, and I think Jim Fallows would agree with me on this, a deepening sense within the American consciousness that, and this was written in the 70s, but may not have been true, but I think Americans feel it more deeply now, that our economy is not rapidly fixable, that in a globalized economy, our problems are indeed structural, and the days of bouncing out of a recession at 4, 5, 6, 7% growth may be gone, and that we're not going to lower our expectations, but we may be more gentle in our retribution of politicians who don't immediately provide that which we've come to expect, at least economically. I think that's one of the central underlying issues of this economy. Yes, the president faces a tough economy. If he's reelected, he will be absolutely historic. No president will have been reelected under economic conditions
like
as
beans.
Bad as this. Mm-hmm. So I think that is the underlying subtext of this whole election. How much do you blame the president? And are you willing to believe that he's at least on the right course? The trajectories may not be satisfactory to you, but at least they're in the right direction. This is a directional election as much as a choice election.
Republicans in Tampa, James Fallows, absolutely unwilling to extend that grace, that second chance of a second term in their rhetoric and their position there. What does the president say tonight to get that part of the country he needs to come over, believe, as Bill Clinton says he does, and say, yes, okay, here are the keys to the car again?
I think he does need to, again, leave most of the demolition to President Clinton, who did it last night, and suggest that he is in control. He's not downcast. He's not defeated. He's optimistic. He has things in mind. There's a very interesting aspect of something a major was saying, which I agree with and would like to extend, which was Mitt Romney, I believe it was Mitt Romney in his acceptance speech last week, was saying that for the first time ever, Americans were concerned about the future relative to the present. Actually, I was talking with the academic who designed that famous question, right direction, wrong course, Sam Popkin of UCSD. And he said that really the only time when people didn't feel that way since the early 1980s was in the last year of Clinton's term. We've been downcast for quite a while, surprisingly.
So Americans have felt that way before, but it's been a deep hole this time, and he's been the president, as Republicans like to say. There's still a vision here. There is excitement in this hall. We see in the polls he's got half the country, but can he get that next bit? James Fallows, please stand by with the Atlantic. Major Garrett with the National Journal. We are in the arena, in the Great Hall, as President Obama prepares to make his speech tonight. 800-423-8255. This is Tom Ashbrook with On Point in Charlotte. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point in Charlotte, North Carolina, at the Democratic National Convention right there. James Taylor, who is performing just down the entryway from us here in the center of the great arena just an hour ago or so. How sweet it is to be loved by you. Of course, the president would love that to be the nation's song as we head into November. We're talking in Charlotte on this last night of the convention about this moment, this night, and Barack Obama about the president's big speech tonight in Charlotte and his challenge as he steps to the podium, steps before his party, and the American people to formally really ask for a second term. James Fallows is with us from the Atlantic. Major Garrett is with us, White House correspondent for the National Journal, and we welcome your calls. What does the president need to say tonight to explain, to lay out? What do you want to hear on the economy, the country, his first term, his view of the future? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. We were on the floor of the convention hall and around today talking with Democratic delegates at the DNC. We asked Garth Corvo of Manchester, New Hampshire, what he thought President Obama needed to accomplish in his big speech tonight.
I think it's simply just saying that it's time that Americans come together and that America is coming back. That I remember President Obama said the night of the New Hampshire primary, there's nothing false about hope. And that's an important thing for people to remember, that we're coming back. It's all right to start getting hopeful again.
Wants to hear we're coming back. Kate Watt from Queens, New York. We asked what she wanted to hear from the president tonight.
That it's going to get better. And that for middle-class families, that he's going to continue to be our advocate and that the opposition just doesn't have middle-class families in mind.
The voice from Queens and from Las Vegas, Loretta Harper. What does she want to hear from President Obama?
President Obama's got to share it to the American people what we've done so far and what we have to do the next 4 years when he's reelected. He just got to assure the American people that we're moving forward. We're moving forward. That's the main thing. We're moving forward, and we got to stay united in everything to win this election.
Delegates of the Democratic Convention, of course, they're wide open, and they hope that the country shares their enthusiasm. Of course, that remains to be seen. We will see in November. Major James, I want to get a lot of our listeners in tonight because they're paying close attention. Barry's calling right now. Lots of people lined up here. But Barry in Charlotte, North Carolina, thanks for calling, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Tom, I would like President Obama tonight to very powerfully, passionately, and unapologetically, and very simply spell out what I think is a huge essential and simple distinction between the Republican vision and the Democratic vision, and I think it can be summarized as a distinction between I versus we. And I wish that he would ask the American people, are we at a historical juncture that is calling us into an individualistic vision of I, or are we at a time when history is calling us to embrace a community-oriented vision of we? And I wish that he would exploit that to the fullest extent possible and make that be a crucial, crucial part of the distinction that he makes between what he's offering and what the other party is offering.
Barry, we've got it. I versus we, the individual versus a more community-oriented approach, and that was big last night from Bill Clinton. And that is a giant kind of a turning point here. If that's what this country, rugged individualism, it's been both.
In direct response to Barry's plea, let me read to you excerpts of the president's speech just released.
Great, let's hear it.
You elected me to tell you the truth, and the truth is it will take more than a few years for us to solve challenges that have built up over decades. Excerpts again of the president's remarks tonight here in Charlotte. It will require common effort, shared responsibility, and the kind of bold, persistent experimentation that Franklin Roosevelt pursued during the only crisis worse than this one. And by the way, those of us, the president says in his remarks, who carry his party's legacy should remember that not every problem can be remedied with another government program or dictate from Washington.
Wow, that sounds like the president doing the straddle one more time.
Tom, you are very perceptive.
Is that Bill Clinton or is that Barack Obama?
It's not exactly the era of big government is over, but it is a nod in that direction.
Cite FDR, but then kind of turn away from him. James Fallows, our caller, raises a kind of fundamental philosophical question and political question. This country, in this century, is it I? Is it we? Is it the individual? Is it community? Is there a new balance, James? Can you speak to it?
I'm at the handicap relative to you all because I haven't seen the actual speech. This is my penalty in being in D.C. rather than Charlotte right now. But the way that Democrats have traditionally argued this, successful Democrats like Bill Clinton and President Obama, hopes he'll be one too, is by appealing to the parts of the American tradition that are both of those. And that's why Bill Clinton was making his point about the we're all in it together vision versus the you're on your own vision, why it's useful for Democrats to refer not just to Franklin Roosevelt, but also to Dwight Eisenhower. A famous Republican, famous military hero who laid the ground for many of the community improvements in America, from the highway system to the educational system. So I expect that's what he'll do. I would hope on a micro issue, the president uses the personal pronoun I relatively less and uses the pronoun we relatively more. I think that would be one subtle way of getting across that message.
I want to pick up that theme that Barry raised with us, again, from Bill Clinton's speech last night. And he starts off here saying, you know, things are going to get better. You will feel it, and that he believes it. But then he turns to the kind of descriptors that he has in mind for the 21st century. Here's Bill Clinton again last night.
Whether the American people believe what I just said or not, maybe the whole election, I just want you to know that I believe it. With all my heart, I believe it. Now, why do I believe it? I'm fixing to tell you why. I believe it because President Obama's approach embodies the values, the ideas, and the direction America has to take to build the 21st century version of the American dream, a nation of shared opportunities, shared responsibilities, shared prosperity, a shared sense of community.
He was fixing to tell you why, and he did. But is that Barack Obama? I mean, here was the great centrist in many ways, James Fallows. But he's laying out very much what our caller did, you know, shared responsibility, shared prosperity, shared sense of community. But we hear major quoting from the speech tonight where Barack Obama gives some of that, the FDR reference, and then says, maybe like Bill Clinton would have in the mid-90s, there's a limit to what government can do.
Sure, and I think we saw the genuine, I'll say, genius in communication of Bill Clinton in that very passage of using the folksy language of his upbringing in Arkansas to make a point that a political scientist could make in some very obscure and off-putting way of talking about the shared way in which America has built both its public and private wealth. I think that will be very consistent with the message that Obama, with his different rhetoric, his more professorial / inspirational air, not that same kind of folksiness that Clinton can pull off, that's essentially the line the Democrats have to draw this year to distinguish themselves, number one, to distinguish themselves, and number two, to say the path they're on will be better if Obama is reelected.
Major, you were in Tampa. The Republicans were very ready to paint these two philosophical roads.
Absolutely.
And they were
rugged
very
individualism
ready to go
against
down that
collectivism.
My family, my people, my effort. You know, Mr. President, I built this company. They were very ready to give Barack Obama the communitarian road that Bill Clinton talked about last night. Will Barack Obama pick that up?
Well, there's no indication of that from the excerpts. The available excerpts, actually, Tom, and I think this will surprise the three of us who are on the show right now, and maybe some of your callers. This reads, at least from the excerpts, like a very much of a status quo speech, very reminiscent of the President's State of the Union address. There is nothing, at least in the released excerpts. Now, maybe they're saving something really eye-popping for the actual presentation. But all of the goals outlined here, increasing manufacturing, jobs, deficit reduction, are all things the President has already released, already talked about before. It is an incrementalist approach, if you will, to a second-term agenda, perhaps chastened by the political realities, perhaps chastened by the knowledge that even if President Obama wins re-election, and it would be historic under these economic circumstances, he will not reach the popular vote total in 2008, 53%. He will be a president with a thinner electoral and popular vote mandate. Maybe he's already reducing his own horizons, and the speech will reflect that. If that's his approach, that would certainly be unconventional, and maybe just enough.
Jim Fallows, you're at the disadvantage of not seeing this as it flows out here, but you're hearing how Major's description of what may be coming tonight. I mean, can a history-making president come back for a second term and be an incrementalist?
The lore of politics, as we all know, is that re-election campaigns are not a referendum but a choice. You know, if there were a referendum on whether things have really gotten, whether America is in satisfactory condition right now, an up or down vote in the abstract on the Obama administration, he would not do well in that. But he's trying to present a choice. It's him against Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan and the party they are bringing with them. So that may be the way he is trying to present his case in the circumstances. You know, it would be exceptional for a president in an acceptance speech to announce an entire new program for his second term, because you'd ask why he hasn't done that so far. But I guess I will be listening with interest to see if it is as sort of limited in its horizons as that text suggests, because people who want to support the president want to hope that there's going to be a brighter time ahead than the sort of the slog of the last few years.
I'd be amazed if he doesn't take it to a high point or several high points here, but that there's also some kind of, well, just down to business in what you're quoting there from the early release of text from the speech, Major. Interesting, today on MSNBC's Mitchell Reports, Andrea Mitchell was talking with a very close senior advisor to the President Obama, Valerie Jarrett. Andrea Mitchell saying, you know, last night in 48 minutes, Bill Clinton seemed to kind of wrap up the narrative of your administration, almost Obama's, almost better than Obama has. Here's that exchange and Jarrett's response.
A lot of people are suggesting Bill Clinton, in 48 minutes, did a better job of rebutting the Republican attack lines on welfare and Medicare and the other attack ads than anyone from the administration, including the president, has.
Well, let's see how you think the president does tonight. My guess is that when the president finishes tonight, what will be crystallized for the American people is exactly why he should be reelected.
Valerie Jarrett, very senior advisor to President Obama. Javier's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Javier, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Hi, very well. What do you think?
Well, I think that the Republican is the party that the obstructionists. From day one, they made the vow or the promise that they were not going to support Obama. And from then, they did just that. They never supported him. Now they're complaining that Obama hasn't accomplished much, but they don't say why. They don't say that it's because of the simple fact that they've been a whole bunch of obstructionists. Every effort that Obama tried to make to better the economy or to get more jobs or whatever, everything, they turned it into a filibuster.
Should the president complain? Should he complain about that tonight in his big speech? Say it's their fault? They obstructed my effort?
I think that it definitely should be something that he should bring up, because that will be the answer. Because a lot of people have that question. Why Obama hasn't accomplished much? Well, the reason is because if you're dealing with a party or a whole bunch of obstructionists, that's the answer. When you have a president that can't work with the opposite party, and that opposite party is not supporting him in any way, shape, or form, then how can you expect that president to accomplish anything?
Javier, we've got it. Of course, I hear you supporting the president in a funny way, though. That is the Republican framing of what's going on, that he hasn't accomplished much. Bill Clinton and others in this week saying there's been a lot accomplished, and let us lay it out. Bill Clinton spending a lot of time on that last night. But, Major, how much can the president complain about opposition, obstructionism here from a party that disagrees with him?
The president will talk about it to some degree, but he will not obsess about it. The country, if you look at the polling data, has absorbed that message quite well. The president will, however, do something I think is important in the context of this election. Remind people that things were accomplished in his first 2 years. I mean, if you think about this entire convention, it's sort of been the greatest hits circa 2009 to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And with the exception of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was a little bit later than that in the lame duck session, many of the things referred to as significant signal accomplishments occurred in the 2 years of strong Democratic majorities in the House, strong Democratic majorities in the Senate. And then this sort of stalemate period in Washington where there was a debt ceiling deal, but there were all sorts of gnashing of teeth and a reduction in the credit rating of the country, temporary though it was, and not much else. So it's a focus on the first 2 years, but the president's probably not going to ask for a Democratic House and Senate because he's not going to get one likely. So I think he's going to leave unanswered the question and perhaps the limited sounding dimensions of this agenda so far in the excerpts will be a silent recognition of that. Well, that he will have diminished horizons. Republicans won't get all that they want if he's reelected, quite obviously. And then Washington is going to have to do something that maybe it's keeping to itself and not really telling its partisans, has come to a different conclusion about the strongly divided partisan lines it's adhered to for the past 2 years.
Well, that would be a surprise. I mean, if the president's as sober as you're kind of portending here, he may find himself way behind the fever level of the people at this convention anyway. Let's go to Elizabeth in Haverhill, Massachusetts. We have to wait and see what he actually says. But, Elizabeth, what do you want to hear?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There are certainly so many issues, but I have a very large concern about women's issues. And my concern is that I am old enough, but just barely, to have been on the cusp of when women have a lot of the rights we have today. My concern is if we lose them, with change laws and Supreme Court decisions, it could be decades before we get anything that resembles what we are accustomed to today.
Do you want to hear the president? There's been a lot said about that this week. Do you want him to address that tonight? He no doubt will. He wants that women's vote. Are you counting on that, Elizabeth?
I am. As the husband of a modern, woman and the father of two teenage daughters, absolutely.
Waiting to hear that from the president tonight. There was a lot on that this week. Last night, women's rights activist Sandra Fluck delivered that primetime address to the convention, comparing women's rights, in her view, in an America under President Obama and under Mitt Romney.
A country that honors our foremothers by moving us forward, or one that forces our generation to refight battles that they already won. A country where we mean it when we talk about personal freedom. Or one where that freedom doesn't apply to our bodies or to our voices. We talk often about choice. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's now time to choose.
Sandra Fluck here last night. Boy, she hit it hard. Do you expect the president to go after those sectors again, women tonight, minorities, Hispanics, to bring them in, or is it a big umbrella?
Absolutely, and I don't expect the president to devote page after page to each of these constituencies, but I would tell you one thing I've observed here, Tom, that I think is interesting and worth noting. Democrats at this convention have talked about gay rights, women's rights, Hispanic rights, or immigrant rights in ways far more confident and far in a far more demonstrative way than I've noticed at previous Democratic conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And
I talked to Stan
Greenberg about this. He's a longstanding Democratic pollster of considerable credibility. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, these social issues, which Republicans used to regard and Democrats used to call wedge issues, Republicans because they were successful, Democrats because they loathed them or were afraid of them, they're embracing them now as part of a larger value structure for the entire party. I expect the president to embrace that because his party likes it and he believes it works well across the country.
We will see soon enough. Major Garrett here with us in Charlotte with the National Journal. James Fallows with The Atlantic joining us from Washington. Listeners, you can join us. Are you Obama solid already? Why? Are you persuadable in this big speech tonight? How? Are you beyond President Obama's reach? Will you listen anyway? For what? 800-423-8255. We're in Charlotte at the Democratic National Convention. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Mary J. Blige at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte tonight as the crowd here readies itself for the big speech from President Barack Obama. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are in Charlotte with James Fallows of The Atlantic and Major Garrett of the National Journal, looking forward to the president's big speech. You can join us tonight. What does a history maker have to do the second time out when it's been tough? Can a speech propel this man again? It did in 2004. It was amazing in 2008 in Denver. History was made. Here we are, 2012, and Barack Obama neck and neck in the polls with Mitt Romney. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Major James Fallows, lots of response on here on Facebook. You've got some who just, we asked, what do you want to hear from the president tonight? Keith, that he is resigning, and I think we got 8 exclamation marks here. Not everybody is persuadable. Ashwin, from the other way, he wants to hear the sound of a steel spine growing, the thunder of facts blowing across empty conservative minds. Colorful there. It's Facebook. Lorianne says she wants to hear that he's going to be more aggressive when fighting for things in Congress. Fewer compromises, bigger stick. Let's hear what Mitt Romney, just to remember what he's responding to tonight, in part what Mitt Romney had to say in his big speech last week in Tampa, criticizing President Obama's first term in office.
Every president since the Great Depression who came before the American people asking for a second term could look back at the last 4 years and say with satisfaction, you're better off than you were 4 years ago, except Jimmy Carter, and except this president. This president can ask us to be patient. This president can tell us it was someone else's fault. This president can tell us that the next 4 years he'll get it right. But this president cannot tell us that you're better off today than when he took office.
Mitt Romney last week in Tampa. Major, how does that hold up? The Democrats have really hammered on that, are you better off 4 years later? Bill Clinton, not least among them last night. But what about that? He can ask us to be patient. He can, you know, say he'll do better.
Right.
But
the Democrats on Sunday, those closest to the president and those who wish him well, struggled with that question quite visibly on the Sunday shows in ways that I found curious. Because
David Axelrod blew for, I mean, right there in the heart of it.
Yes, and Martin O'Malley, a very strong surrogate for this administration, governor of Maryland, said, no, we're not better off. And then the next morning, the answer was, yes, we're better off. For goodness sakes, Martin, everyone else, yes, we're better off. And this goes back to the point that Jim and I were making earlier. What does better off mean? And how do we measure it in the shadow of the Great Recession? And there are indicators that things are getting slowly better. Housing is not as bad. It's still bad, but it's getting better. The stock market is certainly up, but wages are down. Unemployment is high, but it's lower than it was at its peak of 10%. Mm-hmm. What is the underlying trajectory? What is the sense of manufacturing? For months and months, it was improving. The last 3 months, it has contracted. What is the trajectory of all of these long-standing indicators of our economy? Gas prices are up. Bill Clinton said last night, hey, but a fuel standard...
It'll cost half as much because it has to with a higher fuel standard.
Exactly. Yep. He sort of got caught up in that own rhetoric. So if you talk to the two campaigns, which I do with some regularity, they will tell you that because of this underlying sense that nothing is going to change dramatically for the better, regardless of the outcome of this election, there are deeper emotional attachments, trust and likability. And that's why another thing with this convention is you can trust this president because his values of a middle-class American are much more similar to yours than Mitt Romney's.
Again and again. Of course, we heard the opposite last week. James Fallows, what about the tagging of President Obama with the Jimmy Carter label? There's been a lot of it this week. Paul Ryan, again and again this week. You worked for Jimmy Carter. How does that hit your ear? And if you're in the Obama inner circle, what do you do with that?
Well, that certainly is what that is the most advantageous casting of them, just as back in the Jimmy Carter era, the Democrats tried to cast Republicans in the mode of Herbert Hoover, and there was about as much, it was not that much farther back in history of Herbert Hoover in the 1970s
true.
And Jimmy Carter now, so I don't know how that sounds to younger people. What's interesting about, there's an interesting part of the Carter a comparison. If you think of all the things that were going wrong for Carter, the prime interest rate in 1980 was 21%. He had the disaster of the Iranian hostage rescue. He was challenged in his own primaries by Teddy Kennedy. There was a huge split in the party. And still, until a week before the election, he was neck and neck with Ronald Reagan, and not Mitt Romney, Ronald Reagan, the polls. There is more sort of, there's more inertia or momentum behind an incumbent than we often think. So I think that Obama could privately draw some consolation from that, but publicly he should embrace the argument Clinton made last night, was saying, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? Clinton said wholeheartedly, yes, we are. Look at the ways that things, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs being lost per month then, they're being gained now, et cetera. I think that's the argument they have to make.
Charlene in Watertown, Massachusetts. Charlene, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, you asking, you know, what I'd like to hear the president say. I don't want him to make any apologies. I don't want him to remake his case, because I think President Clinton did that amazingly well yesterday. But what I do want to hear him say and tell us is how we move forward, because that's what our country needs right now.
And so cast it forward, cast it forward, cast it forward. But then exactly, Major, you're saying maybe he'll be reluctant to promise too much.
Well, I think he'll say the things he accomplished do move the country forward. He will say healthcare is a step forward that was long time in coming, yeah, and it finally was achieved. Don't ask, don't tell is a step forward. Moving toward energy independence, as he defined it, with renewable energies and experimentation with other kinds of non-fossil fuel energy is moving forward. Trying to address some aspirations of immigrants, even those brought here illegally through no fault of their own, he mm-hmm. will say that's moving forward. I think mm-hmm. he will try to place his agenda quite clearly in that context. What he might not do, to the satisfaction of some listeners, is explain how much more forward things are going to be with the next agenda items he has. And one other quick point about Jimmy Carter. If you ask Obama campaign strategists, and I have a piece on nationaljournal.com about mm-hmm. their very strong confidence in this race, they say, look, the demographics of our country have changed so much that if you lay the results of the Carter-Reagan election over top the demographics now, mm-hmm. Carter loses by 1.5 percentage points, even though he conceded very early that election night, and probably might have won if you lay over those results with a...
It would have been that much closer that much closer. Today's demographics.
And that's why they believe fundamentally, likability, trust, and demographics, plus their get-out-the-vote operation, that they really can't lose this race.
Jim Fallows, you raise Harry Truman, and going further back than that to Herbert Hoover. My colleague Jack Beatty's been listening in here in Charlotte. And he's been listening for something, maybe hoping for something tonight from President Obama out on the campaign trail that he has not heard. Thinking back to LBJ 1964 running against Barry Goldwater. And LBJ with Great Society and New Deal, New Frontier. You know, he was in a little town called Culpeper. And, you know, he would ask the voters, what has Barry Goldwater done for Culpeper, ever done for Culpeper? Goes further back to FDR, who had, you know, a lot of what we now call stimulus, not as much maybe as Barack Obama in real dollar terms, but a lot in the Depression years. And he had a radio address, FDR, talking, he said, you citizens of Seattle who are listening tonight, you've watched the Boeing plant out there grow. Of course, this 1940, this was war buildup. You citizens of Southern California can see great Douglas factories. You citizens of Hartford, look across the Connecticut River at the whirring wheels and the beehive of activity, which is the Pratt and Whitney plant I saw today. James Fallows, why doesn't President Obama look at the results of the spending of $800 billion plus and say, you in this town, you in that state, you in this region, here's what I've done for you. Why don't we hear that, Jim?
I think the place where we've heard it through the Democratic Convention, and we'll hear it more for the next 2 months, is involving the automobile industry. Because that, number one, is centered in the places where the election will turn, notably Ohio. Number two, it's the clearest sort of black-white distinction in terms of starkness between what Obama did and what Romney opposed at the time. Number three, it symbolizes things which are important to what the manufacturing idea of America. Number four, it's supply chain, its ramifications reach beyond Detroit itself. So I think that may be the locus for Barack Obama learning from Lyndon Johnson in this one regard.
Still, why just GM, Major? I mean, there's been spending all over the place, not just in Michigan and Ohio, not just around GM.
Well, the president talks about the economy in far more abstract ways than Bill Clinton does. Bill Clinton is the first successful American president who was a Rhodes Scholar and also can say with complete credibility and believability, Fixin' to. He's a Rhodes Scholar who says, fixing to, and everyone says, yeah, that's right. He's fixing to tell me. Barack Obama cannot do that. Doesn't try to do that. Doesn't phony that up. But his penchant of talking about the economy in somewhat abstract ways, and less particular and down to the, if you will, zip code way that we just heard Franklin Delano Roosevelt, has undermined the people's sense that he's done things that have materially improved their lives. And I don't think he's going to get much better at that. I mean, he just doesn't gravitate in that direction. I agree with Jim that he's going to talk about the auto bailout, and that will be significant. It's already been significant in Ohio. Mitt Romney's campaign cannot gain ground there. And the pollsters in the Republican Party tell me it is because in northern and central Ohio, the bailout works for the president, and it works strongly against Mitt Romney.
It's working there. Bill Clinton said recently, Jim, he said, when people are afraid, explanation beats eloquence any day. We saw that on display with him last night. All those, let me tell you how, I'm fixing to tell you how. Lots of that. You've written about that, Jim. But here's President Obama, so much eloquence, and not as much to my ear anyway, of explanation. What's up with that?
I think each person has a different natural register of things that he or she can talk convincingly about. Lyndon Johnson could talk about being poor in rural Texas because that's what he knew. Bill Clinton was running things in Arkansas, and he can, you know, fix to explain. In Barack Obama's natural register occur issues of social justice, international relations, because he grew up partly outside the United States, and things that are part of his essence and he has credibility on in the way that he doesn't really have on these sort of local economic development issues. So he does his best to explain the things he can, and he is smartly relying on Bill Clinton, as Al Gore did not in 2000, to help make the case in ways that he can't.
Do you think he'll be fierce? I mean, Robert Frost famously said, a liberal's a fellow who won't take his own side in a quarrel. Will he be fierce tonight? There is more than a quarrel going on here. I mean, there is in some way, as our early caller said, there is a kind of battle for the path of the country in this century.
Sure.
Will he be
fierce? I mean, Republicans cast this election as an epic choice, a complete directional decision
for
the country.
So did Bill Clinton last night in many ways.
In many respects, that's right. And I think, based on the excerpts and based on everything that the president has done up until this point of the campaign, he will say, yes, it is a choice. In Chicago, the reelection campaign headquarters of the president, they have been eager to have a choice election. And they think that Mitt Romney has moved more in their direction. That's another reason they feel very confident.
Let's go to Tate calling from Asheville. No, let's get Peter in Champaign, Illinois. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think, Peter?
I'd like to hear from President Obama what some of his specific plans for education are. After listening to Chris Christie trash the teachers' unions in his speech, I'm a proud member of the Illinois Federation of Teachers, and it really hurts me a lot that no matter which president I vote for, there'll be anti-teachers' unions. And so I'd like to hear what Obama's plans for education are. And, you know, I also, you know, kind of don't care what he says today. I'm going to vote for him no matter what. But if I pound any pavement, it's going to be with the Chicago Teachers Union on the picket line.
Peter, we've got it loud and clear from Champaign, Illinois. Major, you know, the president is going to – everybody's praising education in this campaign season. Everybody's saying you've got to have it for a strong American economy. But does the president straddle on that? Because he's got more than just teacher union support. He's been tough with the unions. I mean, supportive overwhelmingly, but still tough with them rhetorically sometimes.
Right. Let me be responsive to Peter's central question by just looking at what the excerpts released so far say about the agenda items the president will talk about on education. Cut the growth of college tuition in half over the next 10 years. Recruit 100,000 math and science teachers over the next decade. Okay. Trade 2 million workers for real jobs at community colleges. All things the president's already said. There's not one thing new there. And there's no nothing in there mentioning Race to the Top, which is a variation of President Bush's No Child Left Behind policy that does, to the mind of the Obama administration and some at the local level, impose higher standards and give incentives to school districts and states that still evaluate much of their progress based on test scores. And that is something that has created a schism between the teachers' unions and both President Bush, and to a lesser degree, but still visible, with President Obama.
It's not easy to be president and ride all these horses at once. Tate in Asheville, North Carolina. Tate, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I'm squarely behind the president. The other side is completely bankrupt with any real effective ideas for moving forward. I do want to say that I hope that we will hear the president speak pointedly about the environment, in particular the lack of leadership from the U.S. EPA and Lisa Jackson. In Region 4 in the South, and I'm calling from Asheville, we have an EPA that is way too cozy with corporations, and I want to hear what he's willing to do to stop corporate pollution that impacts real individuals. In my community, CTS of Asheville has contaminated our groundwater. We have 50 people with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And EPA allowed a Superfund to be developed into a subdivision. And instead of cleaning it up, they blame the next door neighbor whose family has been wrecked with illnesses. And until we can talk about education, and I'm a teacher, so I appreciate the last call. I'm a teacher and a coach. How can we teach children if they're unhealthy because they lack clean air and clean water?
At the very we hear a kind of quiet fury in your description of that right there. People bring what's right around them to their expectations of a president. President maybe hears those, maybe doesn't. Has to look at the whole country. A tougher EPA. Can he satisfy Tate tonight, along with 300 million other?
I can say with some degree of confidence, Tom, that Tate's not going to find that in this speech. And if you look at the activity or lack thereof of EPA in the last 6 to 8 months, it has been to delay implementation of significant pending regulations dealing with industry. And there has been some degree of dissatisfaction among those in the environmental movement who had been looking at these deadlines and anticipating action, specific regulatory announcements from EPA, and they haven't come. They've been delayed until after the election. And the question that naturally arises from that inaction is that meant to soften the regulatory reach of the EPA at a time when the Republicans have, for the better part of 2 years, made it one of the most important, from their point of view, regulatory boogeyman agencies.
Absolutely. Jim Fallows, you've written speeches in the White House. If you could, what would you whisper in the president's ear tonight?
Sound positive, sound hopeful. I thought Bill Clinton did a very useful, one of many useful things last night. And when he was talking about obstructionism, he was seeming somewhat amused about it rather than embittered about it. I think the president needs to show us that he is confident and hopeful, and that's the way to run for re-election.
Well, there's been a tremendous ramp of expectation, yearning, hope, determination built this week here. We saw it from another direction in Tampa last week. A lot here this week among the Democrats. Very, very high expectations for the president tonight. He is an eloquent man. We know that. He's got a big challenge. So does the country. We'll all be listening to see exactly what he has to say. I want to thank my guest tonight, Major Garrett with the National Journal here in Charlotte. Thanks so much, Major, for joining us.
My pleasure as always.
And James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Thank you, Jim.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.